This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
we had a series of serious incidents over the weekend that once again presented themselves as a serious setback to the operations.
That's WHO spokesman talking about the security challenges in dealing with the Ebola outbreak in the DRC. Details next.
Also, heavily armed government forces continue to patrol Kaduna City in northern Nigeria after days of sectarian violence. And the government lifts a ban on importing basic goods that are now scarce in Zimbabwe.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Top story, another rash of deadly attacks is again hampering international efforts to control an Ebola outbreak in the DRC. The outbreak is in a conflict zone where more than 100 armed groups operate. Aid agencies knew from the start that the unstable situation would affect their work. Every time there's an attack, it's followed by angry protests that force health workers to stay indoors. That provides opportunities for Ebola to spread despite a vaccine and new treatment drugs. The death toll now stands at 157 from 244 confirmed and suspected cases. The UN Secretary General and other officials have urged an end to the violence amid concerns that the outbreak could spread to neighboring countries, including Uganda, Rwanda, South Sudan, and Burundi. World Health Organization spokesman Tarek Jaserevich talked with my colleague Paul Alexander about the situation.
We had a series of serious incidents over the weekend that once again presented themselves as a serious setback to the operations because we know from the previous experiences that any security incidents, whatever nature it is, are followed by protests from local population, and that inevitably stalls our operations. We have teams who, again, were not able to operate on Sunday, that on Monday we were operational really at a very low level. And this, unfortunately, will have effect on the overall response. So, again, WHO is appealing to everyone to work toward creating a safe environment in which our teams will be able to access population and do all those necessary measures that are needed.
So how much time and effort is going into security issues each day?
Well, again, the situation is very unpredictable. So what happened really over the weekend, there was a number of incidents that resulted in around 13 civilian deaths. And these incidents range between fighting between rebel and government forces. That happened on Saturday, and then on Sunday, what happened is what we have seen already in the past, that situation was such that population staged a protest in the city because they were not really happy, understandably, with the level of security. They think that, that the government, together with the international peacekeeping mission, is failing to provide that security, and in a response, there was a number of stones being thrown and property being destroyed of response teams. And that obviously will create a situation where we will not be able to function fully. For example, yesterday morning I talked to our teams. Only essential teams were able to go out very early in the morning to their places of work, such as Ebola treatment centers. And then others we were not able to go out. And we know that what this will have as a result is that contacts will not be followed. This is something that has to be done on a daily basis in Ebola response. Those who are on a contact list have to be followed every day, and this did not happen. Some people will simply go away from that contact list and will not be seen any longer. What will that result in turn, is that people who may develop disease will not go immediately to treatment centers and will present danger to their environment. And again, we get into this situation where then we will have to go again, do the epidemiological work, again try to find people who may have been exposed, so the response gets delayed and gets accumulated, if you want.
Considering that this situation does not seem to be getting better, at least as far as security, what does this do for the outlook for bringing this outbreak under control?
Well, it is very simple. In case we are not able to access communities, if in case response measures are not being put in place, safe burials, contact tracing, vaccination, provision of treatment to those who are sick, it is really difficult to hope that the Ebola outbreak can be contained on its own. So it's a very serious situation, and this is something that we have been fearing from the beginning, that the security situation will influence the response to the level that that we cannot really function fully, and that that will be then having a result on the epidemiological curve of the disease.
That's Tarek Jaserovic with the WHO. He was speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander.
Heavily armed government forces continue to patrol Kaduna City in northern Nigeria after days of sectarian violence. Their presence has brought quiet to the city. A 24-hour curfew was imposed following violence that erupted last week. More than 50 people died in a series of clashes between Christian and Muslim youth that began last Thursday. Reporter Gift Agiriga reports from Abuja.
The meadow streets of Kaduna and its environs have been deserted as security operatives enforce the curfew. It was imposed following the Kamino clash at Kaswan Magani in the state's Kajuru local government area. The Kaduna state government allowed capital residents to go out from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. yesterday to restock on essentials before the curfew took effect again. Residents heaved a sigh of relief as thousands trooped out to buy food, gas and other essentials. According to Samuel Arwan, a top spokesman for the state governor, the decision was the outcome of the State Security Council meeting yesterday. He said the security agents are once again patrolling and protecting markets and communities.
We've got massive deployment of security personnel to beef up existing security on ground. Aside that, we are also engaged in outreach to religious and traditional rulers, members of the civil society and other interest groups, and other community leaders or opinion leaders who are also playing a critical role in the area of peace.
He said the curfew will continue until further notice. A reporter for an independent newspaper based in the city, Andrew Abese, said the curfew helped to calm the crisis.
If not, by now Kaduna would have been on fire if there had not been such a measure at the time it came. Rumor was all over the place. People who were of different religions kept getting reports that their people were being attacked. And then there was that urge to do a reprisal, to kill others before the security people were moving. But the government was quick, imposed the curfew, and that saved the situation.
The curfew was aimed at curbing further breakdown of law and order, but also has crippled commercial and social activities in Kaduna. For VOA, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
In Zimbabwe, ordinary citizens have been hit hard by the country's economic crisis. In an effort to resolve food shortages and calm price hikes, the government has lifted a ban on importing basic goods that are now scarce in Zimbabwe. Reporter Kutsayi Zvinovashi has details.
After a cabinet meeting with ministers and the president in attendance Tuesday, the Minister of Information, Publicity and Broadcasting Services, Monica Mutswango, addressed journalists.
The president and cabinet continue to be seized with current hardships which are inflicting on our people, and especially the poorest in society. Cabinet has put primary focus on the general welfare of our people. Shortages of commodities and panic buying continue to afflict our population.
Mutswangwa explained the measure the government has decided to adopt in a bid to resolve the crisis.
The Minister of Industry and Commerce temporarily amends Statutory Instrument 122 of 2017 to allow both companies and individuals with offshore funds and free funds to import specified basic commodities currently in short supply.
The ban on importing some basic goods was introduced to help promote local companies that were barely competing with superior and affordable products from neighboring South Africa. Minister Mutswangwa said the suspension of the ban was effective as of yesterday and will only be reviewed when the situation normalizes. Some of the products that can be imported include body creams, cooking oil, cheese, cereals, bottled water, tinned beans, coffee creamers, fertilizers, and other basic commodities. Munyara Dzidodo is the editor of Open Parli, an online publication that covers parliament and other political developments in the country.
My sentiment on this is that this government is going around in circles. The problem is the bond rates and the government's expenditure, which is 75% of what they're getting.
While this development may mean an end to the shortage of basic goods and panic buying, it also means more businesses will demand the scarce US dollar currency to restock. If that's the case, most ordinary citizens do not have access to dollars. Only bond notes issued by the government that in theory traded par with the dollar. But that's not the case in reality, and many businesses will not accept the notes as payment. Dodo says government doesn't want to phase out the bond notes, rather wants the market forces to do it for them. Zimbabwe's finance minister, Ntuli Ncube, says the suspension of the ban will bring down prices and government will benefit from tax revenues, as some of the banned goods were already finding their way into Zimbabwe through smuggling. Critics, on the other hand, strongly believe this is one blow that will kill Zimbabwe's fragile industry. Only time can tell if this is a step in the right direction. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Eighteen past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. As another World Polio Day comes around, the World Health Organization reports three polio endemic countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria, hold the key to the global eradication of this crippling disease. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
About 500,000 children were becoming paralyzed by polio every year when the World Health Organization began its global polio eradication campaign 3 decades ago. Today, that number has been reduced by more than 99%. WHO reports fewer than 30 cases of the disease this year, many of them in countries that had been considered polio-free. Spokesman for the Polio Eradication Initiative, Oliver Rosenbauer, tells VOA outbreaks have occurred in Niger, Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, Kenya, and Papua New Guinea.
This really, really underscores the risk that we have this disease, that it will continue to reappear, reemerge in areas that had already eradicated this disease. We've seen this time and again. It's not the first time that we're facing new outbreaks again, and we're confident we know what it takes to stop these outbreaks again.
Rosenbauer says these countries are implementing emergency measures to stop the outbreak, but he warns the risk of the wild polio virus spreading across borders will continue until the disease is eradicated in the 3 endemic states of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria.
These 3 countries hold the key to a polio-free world, and they have been battling this disease so very long, but they're making actually tremendous progress this year. Never before have we seen the disease in these countries at such low levels as we are today, this year.
Rosenbauer says Afghanistan and Pakistan have each reported 6 cases of polio. He says no cases of the paralytic disease have been detected in Nigeria, but that, he says, does not mean there are no new cases of the disease there. He notes the wild polio virus is present in parts of Borno State in northeastern Nigeria, which are under the control of Boko Haram militant Islamists. This, he says, makes it too dangerous for health workers to conduct disease surveillance to see whether the virus is circulating. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The murder in Istanbul of the dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, allegedly at the behest of Saudi officials, has made global headlines. But worldwide, hundreds of journalists are attacked, imprisoned, or even killed every year by those in power. To find out more about the dangers journalists face in Africa, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Angela Kintel, the Africa coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, a global nonprofit dedicated to press freedom. Adam began by asking her why she thinks the Khashoggi story has caught fire in the public imagination.
Well, I guess it's caught fire simply because this is an international journalist, someone who was working as a columnist for the Washington Post and therefore would have the sort of profile that would get people to take note. That's generally not the case with the vast majority of murders that you see of journalists, because these are generally local journalists in countries that often the international community doesn't particularly care about. I mean, let's be real.
So what about the news out of Africa? Are things good or bad, improving or getting worse?
I'd say it's mixed. Let's just talk about the good news in terms of journalists in jail. At the end of 2017, in terms of our prison census, we had 39 journalists in jail for their work. As I sit here and I talk to you, we're down to only 15. Now, that is tremendous. And the 15 are only in one country, Eritrea. Eritrea has been on our census list since 2001, when the Eritrean government decided to get rid of the independent press and started jailing many, many journalists. And to this day, we're not even sure whether they're still alive, because the situation there is just so opaque. And unfortunately, the international community seems to ignore what is going on there.
To go back to the good news, you say the numbers have gone down enormously. What do you attribute this positive trend to? I mean, why do you suppose things are so much better these days?
Let me use the example of Ethiopia. In 2016, we had 16 Ethiopian journalists in jail. Last year, over the same period, we were down to 5. Right now, there are none. You do have a reformist prime minister, a young prime minister. He has opened up the space for journalists and others.
Yet the killing of journalists has continued somewhat in Africa over the past year.
We've had 3 journalists killed in the Central African Republic and 1 other journalist in Libya. In the Central African Republic, 3 Russian journalists who were investigative journalists who were visiting the country because they were following up on the mercenary group with links to President Vladimir Putin, and they were murdered. They were found dead in a vehicle. And we're trying to get to the bottom of what really happened. There are conflicting sources of information. The problem with murders of journalists, as we see all over the world, is the complete impunity. So when people are murdered, to try and actually find their killers or to hold the killers to account is almost impossible.
What about Zimbabwe?
Look, it always helps when you have new governments. Zimbabwe's not out of the woods yet, but certainly we've seen some change there.
I understand things are very bad for free press and for journalists in Cameroon.
Cameroon is very bad. The repression that we have seen in Cameroon under President Paul Biya has played itself out in the media as well. Cameroon has used anti-terror legislation against journalists and opposition and anyone who is critical of the government. While we saw many journalists released last year, including the famous case of Ahmed Abba, the Radio France International journalist who had also been accused of terrorism, we still have journalists in jail in Cameroon as we speak.
Is danger to journalists most critical in Africa as opposed to other places?
Definitely not. I mean, every continent has journalists who are seen and being regarded as the so-called enemies of the state. So no, Africa is certainly not alone in the way that it treats journalists or abuses journalists. Here in North America, we have problems as well, and we have the problem in the United States. I think at the end of the day, this is not about only journalists. This is about the public's right to know. Once you kill a journalist, you are killing the public's right to know. It's the journalist today. It could be you, the citizen of a country, tomorrow.
That was Angela Quintal, the Africa coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. She spoke with our colleague, Adam Phillips, in New York.
In recent months, the South African and Zimbabwean leaders have been wooing Western investors, a task that is proving daunting. With lagging foreign direct investment, there is a growing consensus on the need for more African companies to explore opportunities on the continent. VOA correspondent Adi Gondo reports.
Analysts say trade between African countries has the greatest potential for building sustainable economic development and integration. According to new data from the African Development Bank, inter-African trade expanded from 10% in 2000 to about 16% in 2014, reflecting the continent's recent economic upturn. Africa's GDP and its internal trade expanded fourfold over the past two decades, a sign of the success in marketing the continent's manufactured goods. They are less susceptible to price shocks that affect tea, cocoa, or minerals, commodities that make up over half of the trade between Africa and industrialized nations. There are, however, challenges to developing Africa trade. Economist Dr. Gift Mgano says these include infrastructure, including road and rail networks.
If you are taking your product in Zimbabwe to a regional market in Africa, according to World Bank, it shows that it costs between $100 to $300 US dollars, not RTGS, per ton. So what it means is that if you are carrying a 30-ton truck, you spend $9,000 on transport to reach a destined market on average in Africa. And in many cases, this is more than the value of the goods in that truck. So it then affects the competitiveness of trading as a result of transport. The studies by African Development Bank also shows that in Western Africa and Central Africa, and the delays at the border, we don't have enough ports. And these delays are creating a lot of chaos.
Other barriers to inter-African trade are low energy supply, poor ICT connectivity, and import regulations within African nations. Dr. Mgano says, despite these challenges, there's still great potential for investment.
Africa has a vast opportunity because we have over 1 billion people, so there's a large market which can be tapped into. So there are opportunities for value chain development where Zimbabwe could be a producing tobacco. But we can take even Malawi and Tobago and process it because Malawi is not adding value, you see. They sell it in Africa as cigarettes. But what is happening, we are selling raw materials to all of us. So I believe there are opportunities of providing products which are complementing each other. So far, we have not done so to say, what is it Zimbabwe is good at? And what is it South Africa is good at? Because we are not working together to identify areas of opportunity.
Analysts say that Africa's trade and regional integration depends on the success of its regional blocs, which can help reduce administrative and transaction costs. They say improved transportation and communication infrastructure must connect African countries with each other and the rest of the world. Policymakers say the situation is gaining in importance as China expands its economic clout, debt to China begins to increase, and Africans grow concerned over the use of Chinese workers in its projects based in Africa. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo from Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Alfredo Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.